from the Sky News Centre at 6. A right-wing terrorist has given a Nazi salute in court after being jailed for life for a plot to kill his local MP. Convicted paedophile Jack Renshaw bought a 19-inch knife to murder Rosie Cooper in 2017. The 23-year-old was stopped after being reported by whistleblower Robbie Mullen.
He told us he wanted to talk to us and he looked all serious. He looked sad at the same time. Something was wrong with him. And then he told us about his plan to kill his local MP.
Renshaw will serve at least 20 years in prison. Theresa May's hopes of passing a Brexit agreement have suffered a big blow after Jeremy Corbyn called an end to cross-party talks. The Labour leader says government instability made a compromise impossible, but the Prime Minister is blaming splits in the opposition over a second referendum. The Foreign Office says people who have both British and Iranian nationality should not travel to Iran. It's changed its advice because of what it calls Tehran's continued mistreatment of dual nationals. The inquest into the deaths of 8 people in the London Bridge terror attacks in 2017 has heard a nurse was stabbed to death while trying to save another victim. Australian Kirsty Bowden, who was called the Angel of London Bridge, was set upon by all 3 attackers. Aberdeen's Derek McInnes says he's not ready to walk away from club management to take over as Scotland boss. He was thought to be on the shortlist as a possible successor to Alex McLeish, but McInnes is ruling himself out of the running.
I would like to be Scotland manager at some point. I think anybody coaching and managing would have aspirations to manage a country, wherever that may be. And for me, I see myself, what to do at Aberdeen. I'm a club manager and I'm not ready to give that up in my mind. So those are the conversations I've had with the chairman regarding that.
And we now know the Duchess of Sussex didn't have her baby at home. Her son Archie's birth certificate shows he was delivered at the private Portland Hospital in Westminster. That's the latest.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Conservative councillor for Henbury and Brentree, Chris Windows. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, oil tankers attacked, hold, and an Aramco Saudi oil pipeline pumping station grinds to a halt after being attacked by what are believed to be Iranian drones controlled by Yemen's Houthi rebels. We speak to one of the world's foremost military experts, who was chief Iraq weapons inspector back in 2003. What does he think of Mike Pompeo and the prospects for escalation of the war on words or a hot war between the US and Iran? That's Scott Ritter. Also, Bristol's medieval past as Britain's second city and exploring the world. Professor Peter Fleming from the University of the West of England joins us to explore our city's ignominious history. That's all in the second hour. After the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So tonight, lows around 9 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs at 18 Celsius, light cloud and a gentle breeze. Warming up, highs next week around 18 again. Plenty of sunny spells and a few showers next week. Next weekend, the 25th and 26th of May. Highs get around 16, a bit cooler. Sunshine and showers again, though. That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is Conservative councillor for Henbury and Brentree, Chris Windows. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi there. Thanks very much.
Can you tell us if the Conservatives are going to win next week's Euro elections?
Euro elections? Oh, is there something I should know?
Yes. I mean, there is a European elections, and in the past, David Cameron was rather worried, your leader, that the UK Independence Party was overtaking the Conservatives and also, to be fair, the other main parties during these elections. So are you been campaigning out on the campaign trail, trying to get votes in?
I think that's probably a no.
Why is that?
Because I haven't.
Why not, though? Why? Have you, I mean, surely you want your party to win, don't you?
Well, I had to get my hair cut this week. And also, I had to see the grandchildren.
I'm also joined on the line by Stuart Adair, who's a Gloucestershire coordinator for the Brexit Party. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, good afternoon, Tony, and good afternoon to you, Chris.
Hello, good afternoon.
So, I would imagine you're campaigning with a bit more vigour. The thing is with this Brexit Party, though, Stuart, a new party which is polling ahead of all the others, which is quite astounding, really, for normal politics, is what are your actual policies?
Well, it's really simple, and our manifesto is just to enact the democratic decision taken by the British people for us to return to a trade-only arrangement with the European Union. It's really, really simple.
But it wasn't a trade, hang on, because it was to leave the EU. Now, that doesn't mean to say necessarily leaving the customs union or the common market, as we called it, does it?
Well, I think during the EU referendum, I think people were fairly clear and they understood exactly what they were voting for, and that was to return to, hopefully, a free trade arrangement with the European Union.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I don't think you really quite would see eye to eye with him on that. There was campaigning around trade, but it certainly didn't seem to be clear to me that it was we were going to be necessarily leaving the customs union or leaving the common market. The EU, which is the political side of it all, that's surely what we were leaving, wasn't it?
I think that's right. I think Nigel Farage himself said in the run-up to the last to the referendum that voting to leave the EU didn't necessarily mean leaving the single market. Now, I know the debate's moved on since then, and there's definitely a tendency in the society that wants to have a no-deal Brexit. That's fair enough, but I don't think they've got a majority, and if they haven't got a majority, they ain't going
to
get it.
Well, why do you think it's so important to leave the common market or leave the customs union? It actually quite annoys me the way it's been almost rebranded the common market as a customs union, but why so important to leave it, Stuart?
I think it's quite... because we need to free ourselves up from the burden of EU regulation, and we need to open our markets up to trading with countries right across the world. Look, we have to remember that the European Union trades with over 100 countries, including China, Russia, the USA, India, Brazil. None of those other countries are subject to the burden of EU regulation in the same way that Britain is. And I want us to be able to trade with countries which are growing, should we say, the USA at 2.4%, India at 7.3%, and Asia at 5.7%, and not be tied to the European Union, where we're tied to a growth forecast of 0.3%. So there's a big wide world out there. And once we free ourselves from the burden of this EU regulation and the trade controls that are in place, then it's all there waiting for us.
Chris Windows, you're a Conservative councillor. Will you be voting for the Brexit Party?
Well, I don't think actually that's instructions that's come down from Conservative office. But I'm not going to argue with our friend. The country did vote to come out. And that's what we should do.
But it's not supposed to work that way, is it? It's not supposed to be instructions coming down from either Labour or Tory central office or anywhere else. It's supposed to be the people making a decision and the servants of the people, that is the Conservative Party, Labour Party or whoever, obviously in different factions, they're supposed to do what we tell them, aren't they?
Yeah, they probably are, but I'm not sure if anybody's told them that. You know, there's no arguing. We voted as a country to come out. Right now, whether you agree with that or disagree with it, there was a majority to come out, and that should have happened on, I think, the 29th of March.
So should Theresa May, because of all those promises, should she go? I mean, there's a lot of talk about her going now, and if so, who should replace her?
You may find this difficult to believe, but nobody in Westminster actually listens to me. I don't think I'm important enough.
No, but we do. I mean, and also your voters may listen to you. Who do you think should replace her?
They're not going to ask me that, not until they got down to the final two that they've decided upon, and then I'll be one person being in the opportunity to help choose which should be the leader.
Are we going to have another betrayal of the Conservative members again, like last time, where Andrea Leadsom fell on her sword over the weekend, and so there was no actual election to put Theresa May in charge?
Let's put it this way, it'll be very interesting to see what happens this time.
Stuart Adair, as I say, you're Gloucestershire coordinator for the Brexit Party. Do you have any other policies other than leaving the EU?
Right now, we're focused wholly upon the European Union elections. I have heard rumour that there is a manifesto to take us forward into other elections, but right now, I've not seen that in black and white. So right now, all I'm focused on is leaving the European Union, driving us to the European Union elections, and then we'll take stock after that, I think.
What about things like nationalisation or privatisation? Because that's one of the things that many people have said, that the EU actually does put restrictions on here in the UK and other countries, whether we can nationalise things or privatise things. We've seen the disastrous attempt to privatise the probation service, which has caused absolute turmoil in the criminal justice system, and now the government this week admitting it's got it all wrong and now renationalising it. But do you have any views on maybe the more higher profile nationalisations or privatisations, like things like water or particularly the railways?
I think it will be wrong for me to second guess what the Brexit Party policies may be when they get to that level of detail. And I may say something now that isn't true when these policies come out, and that will be completely wrong. So I'm going to skip that question if you'll allow me to do that, because it would be wrong of me to give wrong information to people at this time.
Also, I've seen some information circulating on social media and elsewhere that there are plans by the Brexit Party to privatise the NHS and to sell it off to the United States healthcare firms.
But I certainly not seen that. I shall also the same politics. I'll refer the honourable gentleman to the answer I gave some moments ago, I think is what they say, isn't it? As I say, I really am not going to get dragged down into that level of detail, because I haven't seen anything formally from the party hierarchy, and it would be wrong of me to give wrong information out or to guess or to just waffle on when I've not seen it for officially myself.
I mean, what would you say to those that say, well, actually, this is a very clever way of getting power, but actually not necessarily telling the voters what you're going to be doing with it?
Well, I think the message seems to be getting across that we're really focused on Brexit, because today's polling come out, and I made a note of the results. I think from the YouGov poll, we're at 35% in the EU election polling. So we seem to be storming ahead at the moment, just with the message that we've got. So whatever we're doing seems to be the right thing at the moment. So I'm going to stick to that party line.
For those who are confused about the differences between the Brexit Party and the UK Independence Party, I'm sure thousands, if not tens of thousands, of pencils hovering over little boxes next week thinking, well, what's the difference between these two? Which way do I go?
That's a very fair point. And look, absolutely full disclosure, I used to be a member of UKIP, and I left because Gerard Batten took the party to a fairly unpleasant political grounds with welcoming in Tommy Robinson, although not a party member, but certainly embracing his views and his politics, and the likes of Carl Benjamin. And I left because I didn't want to be associated with those people. And I think, again, people aren't daft. I think they can see what's going on and what these individuals are saying and what they're writing. And I certainly wouldn't support UKIP whilst Gerard Batten is leader and whilst it's associated with those two particular individuals. So I think people are fairly clear about the difference between UKIP and the Brexit Party.
Okay.
I hope they are.
Okay, Stuart Adair, Gloucestershire coordinator for the Brexit Party, thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show. Martin, they are way ahead in the polls, and they're likely to romp home, absolutely shaming the major parties, who of course are much better funded than the Brexit Party, Labour and Conservative. So I'll ask you that question first. Are you a bit ashamed that you've failed to capture the polls before next week's vote on Thursday?
I think the Brexit Party is more of a threat to Chris's party than it is to the Labour Party. The Labour Party problem is that we're going to lose a lot of votes, Remain voters, who are fed up with the pussyfooting around on our side of the fence. So it's going to be very interesting to see how it pans out. If the Brexit Party achieves 50% plus one, then it's a no-deal Brexit. But if they don't, then it's not. And that may be no Brexit at all. Because if you haven't got a majority, you can't do anything.
Is that the case? Do you think if the Brexit Party does very well that the Conservative minority government will just be forced to have a no-deal Brexit, Chris?
Oh, it's very, very difficult to say what's going to happen at this moment in time. I don't think any of the Westminster parties have behaved in a way in which they can be proud. Unfortunately, we're stuck with what they do, or in this particular case, what they don't do or haven't done.
So you wouldn't answer the question about who you think might you favour for leader if Theresa May disappears over the next few weeks. Martin, what do you think? Because Boris Johnson's obviously been tipped for the top, yeah. Although there's a lot of Conservative MPs that say because of him having his foot in his mouth when he was Foreign Secretary, that he's actually precluded himself.
No, I think what will happen is that he'll be one of the two that's chosen to be in the final, you know, the final jump off or whatever you're going to call it. And he's likely to win because he's the one people have heard of. I mean, I think, you know, he's got the profile. But whether he can actually lead the party, I mean, he's still got to go back to Brussels and they're going to say Irish backstop. And at that point he goes, ah, what are we going to do about that? We can have a no-deal Brexit, but the Irish backstop comes back in because then you've got to do a deal with the EU, even under no deal, and the Irish are going to insist on a backstop for that. Otherwise, you're going to lose your car industry, your aerospace industry, all the stuff earlier that was about getting out of EU regulations and doing deals with all these other countries. Frankly, that's fantastical. None of that's going to happen.
I think what most people tend to forget is that money is what makes the world go round, and nobody either in this country or in Europe is going to take any decisions which are going to hit them in the pocket. They will avoid that where possible. So it's all about money. So we just wait and see whatever happens with staying in, going out, or anything else. But I'll put my neck on the line now and say that personally I would rather that we stayed in than we did the deal that I've seen on the table. I don't feel that is a deal.
That's a very interesting point of view, because of course I can live with that as well, because basically if we stay, the deal on the table I can kind of live with, but basically we're in the EU, we don't have any say. So you might as well be in it in that case.
Oh, you might as well be out of it.
One or t'other, but you can't just leave because you've got Scotland and Ireland in particular using the EU to block it.
I'll tell you another reason you can't leave, and that's because you're stuck apparently in a reality TV show and you're never going to be allowed to leave. This is the
Hotel California.
This is the opinion of Archduke Karl of Austria, who describes Brexit as the reality TV show. This is the Archduke of Austria, Karl von Habsburg, described Brexit as a reality show. He made the comments in a speech following his re-election as leader of something called, which we haven't really seen much on Newsnight, International Pan-European Union, the oldest of the current organisations in the world, promoting European unity. He won the leadership contest last month with 100% of the votes. Archduke Karl said he was grateful for the renewed trust and went on to speak to the movement about his thoughts on the current European political situation. He said, it's only a week before Brexit. Actually, this is back in March, and middle of March, and still nothing is decided. Brexit shows there is no alternative to Europe. The EU is committed to success. The world and Europe are in turmoil. The one hand because of the unclear circumstances of Brexit, and the other because of populism that is rampant in many countries. But I didn't even know about this organisation, Chris Windows, the International Pan-European Union. I think I'd better ask Martin, have you been invited to join?
No, I saw him speak at a conference I went to in Zagreb in Croatia in the 1990s. And of course at that stage the Croatians were trying to break out of Yugoslavia and join the European Union. That's why he was there.
But this is the landed gentry.
He's actually the descendants of the people who used to be the emperor, but of course they were deposed at the end of the First World War, and they still exist, but they don't have the same power they used to have.
He's not managing director anymore, but he still holds the shares, doesn't he? He's got the land.
Well, I mean, basically they are very wealthy people that used to run the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and when they were deposed at the end of World War One, they didn't go away. They carried on being around, and they've got a vision. Don't forget the Holy Roman Empire, which goes back right to the Middle Ages, Charlemagne,
we'll be talking about that
and
in
so
a second
on.
Now, yeah.
You know, this idea of a Europe united but diverse is part of the historical memory of countries like Germany and Austria and so on. So, and of course, all the wars and everything have brought that very strongly into focus.
I mean, you get an idea, Chris, don't you, that people like this have been sort of hanging around playing golf or whatever for a few hundred years. Their families have, anyway, and now they're saying, actually, well, we're now in the driving seat again.
Well, we're talking about Austria and the people that sort of influence Austria. I do know about Anschluss, but other than that, I'm not really familiar with it, except that it's got a beautiful countryside. I know I've driven through it.
Well, since we're talking a little bit about history, I thought it'd be quite interesting to go back. I spoke to Alan Brown earlier this week, who's a left-wing activist, and he's just done a economics degree up at the University of the West of England, about the origins of the European Union, which I thought was fascinating, through someone called Wild Bill Donovan. Martin, have you come across him?
Yeah, well, he's basically OSS, CIA.
Yeah, and Alan Dulles, who was over in Switzerland, been making things very nice for Hitler's foreign exchange during Second World War. And also the Ford and the Rockefeller Foundation. So let's have a listen to what Alan had to say now.
The American Committee for United Europe was set up in 1948 as part of this Cold War strategy, is to have a kind of united Europe as a bulwark against Russia, or the USSR at the time. This was set up, was chaired under William Donovan, the former head of the OSS, which was the forerunner of the CIA, the Office of Strategic Studies. His second command was Alan Dulles, later to be head of the CIA. Now, they funded two organisations, the Action Committee for the United States of Europe under Jean Monnier in 55, and the European Movement set up in 47. They funneled CIA funding via the Rockefeller and Ford Foundations.
Well, he slipped a little word in there, didn't he, Martin? CIA money. So this was why were the CIA so interested in creating a united Europe at the end of the Second World War?
Because they didn't want the communists to take power in France and Italy, which they're about to do. And they spent a lot of money keeping the communists out of power in Italy. They brought the mafia back. And Lucky Luciano was taken out of prison in New York and sent back to get the mafia behind the Allies in Sicily and so on. And there's a real possibility at the end of the war, in France particularly, that these countries were going to go communist. So the whole EU project was set up by the CIA to prevent a communist takeover in Western Europe. And they set up the Gladio networks at the same time.
But right now we are talking about British industry. I mean, there's this whole problem with British steel at the moment. I'm not sure to what extent any of this Brexit discussion is going to help those who are fearing losing their jobs at British Steel or their pensions. But this came up at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday this week.
Simon Clark!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. At a crucial time, can I take this opportunity to highlight the absolutely vital importance of supporting British Steel, and in particular the world-leading Special Profiles Division at Skinning Grove in my constituency. This is a profitable business and a jewel in the crown of UK steelmaking. And can I urge my right honourable friend to deliver a productive outcome to the talks that are ongoing as swiftly as possible?
Yeah. Well, my humble friend has raised an important point about the British Steel, and obviously I can't comment on the speculation about the future of Greybull Capital-owned British Steel. I realise this is a worrying time for those who are employed there and their families. As everybody would expect across this House, the Business Department is in regular contact with a wide range of sectors and companies. But of course, last month, the government did enter into a commercial agreement with British Steel relating to their obligations under the EU Emissions Trading Scheme, which has provided support to that company.
Well, that's a bit of a mealy-mouthed response from Theresa May. Not quite sure how long she's going to be at Prime Minister's Questions giving these answers, but wasn't a very satisfactory response, really. I mean, the thing is, Chris, steel is a strategic industry. British Steel is on the point of collapse.
Yeah, it's one of these difficult things, isn't it? You've got China that's making an awful lot of steel and selling it very cheaply. You've got the United States who are messing about with the world markets. We're no longer a very, very strategic power in the world. You know, we've got...
Is it okay to buy our steel from China if it's cheaper and sack people here? I mean, this is one of the reasons Donald Trump was elected, isn't it? He said in the US, he said, we've had enough of being undercut from abroad. We're going to stop these. Because, I mean, the Chinese, Martin, am I right, actually subsidised their steel production in order to try and make sure they can continue selling it?
Well, they basically intervened in the market, in their internal market in 2008, and if they hadn't, the whole world market would have collapsed. And this trade that there's today, they've taken in an Iranian oil tanker in defiance of Trump's you're not to deal with Iran. They've said that they're not going to allow Huawei to operate at all in the United States, whatever happens. Basically, this trade war is turning into a world war quite quickly, and when it kicks off, as it may well in the Gulf of Hormuz, and we're going to talk about this later on, then Brexit's going to look like pretty small beer.
Yeah, but I mean, what about the future for those who in a strategic British industry, which we, I mean, surely we need steel, don't we? Unless we're going to say, oh, we're going to, we don't need steel. No?
Not necessarily. I mean, you may or you may not. I mean, there's plenty of countries that don't have a steel industry. It's not an essential thing anymore. And we don't actually do much manufacturing. When we used to do loads of manufacturing, it made sense to protect it. So British Steel was nationalised to protect it from collapse.
I mean, isn't this what the lost leaders do? That they make sure that there's loads of cheap stuff available until you're, you know, your little corner shop collapses because they can't compete with the supermarket. Mm. And then, once the supermarket's all there is, up the prices go.
Well, yeah, but it's also to do with long-term strategic planning about investment in research
so
and development and high technology.
Here?
Well, let's just put it this way. We haven't got a Huawei in this country because we don't do electronics anymore. We gave up on that a long time ago.
Well, the Germans brought it out, didn't it? Siemens mostly.
Well, exactly. So the point is that the idea of having an industrial policy went out the window in 1979, which is why we've been been various waves of de-industrialisation caused by house price bubbles in the southeast, which then leads to putting the brakes on, and so we've ended up with no industry.
Can I just I spotted an article in the Financial Times yesterday saying British Steel secures new funding from lenders to keep operating. Stopgap arrangement agreed, but details of the amount of funding has not been disclosed. British Steel says it secured new funding from lenders to ensure it keeps running, handing a reprieve to the company and its thousands of workers after talks with the government over a £75 million bailout. An impasse. The UK's second largest steelmaker sought the emergency taxpayer funds to stave off collapse 2 weeks after ministers agreed a £120 million loan to help the business meet payments due under an EU environmental scheme. Now, okay, so I guess they're thinking, well, once we're out of the EU, they won't have to pay this money for this EU environmental scheme. I'll put a link up to that on our show page anyway on the Financial Times.
The money's coming from the EU, Tony, under the scheme. And once we're out, we won't get that bailout.
No, payments are due.
Yeah, but once we're out of the EU, we're not going to get that EU money, are we? So the British taxpayer will have to find that 75 billion.
2 weeks after ministers, I'll just repeat what I said. 2 weeks after ministers agreed to a £120 million loan to help the business meet its payments, which are due under an EU environmental scheme. So that's money that's going to the EU. Anyway, this would have been a bit embarrassing if British Steel had collapsed on the eve of European elections, Chris, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it certainly would have done, yeah. I mean, we're still talking about the EU, and you mentioned how long it's been really on the table to have European unity. But as far as I remember, it was mentioned in the Bible, which was a lot earlier.
Was it? Bible, whereabouts?
I think they called it the Tower of Babel.
Well, the Tower of Basel, which is the Bank for International Settlements building in Switzerland, where all the central bankers meet, which is also nicknamed as the Tower of Basel. So it's actually a nickname for the headquarters of the Bank for International Settlements. So let's go back to Prime Minister's questions. And next, we've got more talk about these sorts of trade deals, and we'll discuss that with Chris and Martin when we've heard from. Wednesday's Prime Minister's questions again.
Nigel Evans!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can the Prime Minister confirm that if we were to stay in a customs union and a single market, that we'd have to pay billions into the European Union, that we couldn't do free trade deals around the world, and we couldn't control our own immigration, and that we will never betray the promise that we made at the last general election, that we will deliver the full Brexit, unlike the broken promises from the party opposite?
I say to my right honourable friend, I'm happy to confirm to him that we do indeed remain committed, not just to delivering Brexit and to securing a majority in this House to do just that, but I can reassure him on his specific points. In leaving the European Union, we will end free movement, restore full control over our immigration policy, open up new trading opportunities around the world, and end the days of sending vast payments to the European Union. And we will not pay for market access. And he mentions the last election and commitments that were made at the last election, because he and I both stood on a manifesto promising to deliver the best possible deal for Britain as we leave the European Union, delivered by a smooth, orderly Brexit, as we seek a new, deep and special partnership, including a comprehensive free trade and customs agreement with the European Union. I'm committed to those objectives. I believe that we've negotiated a good deal that delivers on those, and I'm determined to deliver it.
Chris, she keeps saying she's determined. This week, the talks between your party and Labour collapsed, didn't they?
Yes, apparently. I heard today that they had collapsed.
I mean, wasn't that all just a bit of a show for the public that they weren't ever going to get anywhere? For the last 6 weeks, they've been really taking a mickey out of us, haven't they? Pretending to negotiate when there was never really any chance.
It came as no surprise to me that it didn't go anywhere.
Martin, did it come any surprise to you that it didn't get anywhere?
No, absolutely not.
So was it all just another way of kicking the can down the road?
Yes, basically. Yes.
How long is she going to be able to get away with continuing to do this? Well, she's got problems in her own party.
Well, I understand that they're going to bring back the deal again in June after the European election, but it looks pretty clear it'll go down. It'll go down because, as you say, the right wing of the Tory party with Brexiteer party breathing down their necks want to have what they're saying there. We want to leave.
It's the 3rd of June, apparently.
Yeah, we want to leave and we want to do our own trade deals. And what the EU said to that is you can, but you've got to exclude Northern Ireland from that because they voted to stay in the EU and that's what the backstop's all about. Now, if they weren't being propped by the Ulster Unionists, they could say, fine, Ireland can stay in the single market and we'll do what we like. But of course, they can't do that because the DUP are holding the government.
Chris, Theresa May really is coming through an immense amount of criticism here, not just from your own party, but from right across the world and within Britain too. She's clinging on to power when she knows she's not wanted. She's trying to have another vote on her deal, which is almost certainly not going to be voted for again. Why is she clinging on like this? Why doesn't she just resign? And it's sort of painful to watch her, really. And it's painful for the country because we are not getting anywhere. We're not progressing.
That would mean a change of leadership, wouldn't it? I cannot see that a change of leadership at this point in time when nothing's been decided is going to be helpful to anybody, certainly not helpful to the country. Now, you say she's holding on and she's
clinging on.
But I have to say, although I don't agree with the plan that she's come up with, I do have a great deal of admiration for somebody who will try and stick to what they believe in.
As a replacement, could I list a few people and you tell me anyone you think would be good? Michael Gove, Matthew Hancock, who I hadn't heard of, but he's the Health Secretary apparently, Jeremy Hunt, Sahid Javid, we've got obviously Boris, Andrea Leadsom, Dominic Raab, Rory Stewart is also apparently in the game. Any of those you think might you'd like to put your money on?
I'm gambling aware.
Martin?
Well, I think what'll happen is Boris Johnson's a shoo-in for this, basically. But, of course, he's got exactly the same... All he'll inherit is exactly the same political arithmetic as...
I mean, it's
Theresa May.
I mean,
he can flounder around for a bit.
You could be quite cynical, couldn't you, and say, well, actually, this is just the Bullingdon Club coming back, you know, after their little session back in 2010, and, you know, with George Osborne and David Cameron. Mm. He's another buller, isn't he?
Well, he is, yes. And, of course, he's got... You know, he carries lots of baggage with him. But nothing changes the basic politics of the situation is the Irish aren't going to back down on the backstop. You can't have a no-deal Brexit because the DUP are going to block it unless you have a general election, which is what the Labour Party have been pushing for all along. And, of course, under the previous setup before the Continuous Parliament Act, we'd have already had a general election by now, which would have settled a lot of this. There'll be one in the end.
So let's have it. I mean, there are some serious rebels in the Tory camp now, and it really is, like waiting for Godot, watching to see how long Theresa May can cling on for.
Mr. Peter Bone. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. For more than 20 years, I've worked with an incredible group of Conservatives in Wellingborough and Rushton. They raise money for the party, they deliver leaflets, and they knock on doors, week in, week out. This Saturday, 40 of us went out campaigning for the European elections. But unfortunately, sir, I have here a letter from those Conservatives addressed to the Prime Minister. They say that her deal is worse than staying in the European Union, that they want us to come out now on a no-deal basis. And, sir, more importantly, they've lost confidence in the Prime Minister and wish her to resign before the European elections. Prime Minister, what message do you have to say to these dedicated and loyal Conservatives?
How can I say to... First of all,
honourable colleagues, can I say to my honourable friend, I say to those members of the Conservative Party across the country who campaign regularly for elections of all sorts. We've just heard of that group in Redditch who succeeded in getting excellent results in Redditch Borough Council elections. All Conservatives who campaign, I first of all thank them for the time and effort that they put into promoting the Conservative cause. And secondly, I would say to Conservatives up and down the country who are concerned about delivering Brexit, this is a government that wants to deliver Brexit and has been working to deliver Brexit. Sadly, so far, the House of Commons has not found a majority to do that. If everybody in the House of Commons had voted alongside with the government and the majority of Conservative members of Parliament, we would already have left the European Union.
She's blaming the House of Commons, really, Chris. It's her fault, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. It's her fault because she is the Prime Minister. But it's not her fault that there are so many people that disagree with her and are in a position to stop what she's doing.
So there's actually a court case going through at the moment, Martin, that says that because of the original vote that we had to pass the Article 50 Bill Act, that Britain has left, apparently, on the 29th of March, legally, and that she is illegal. She's committing a crime or whatever. I don't know if it's a crime. I can't imagine her going to jail for it anyway. But anyway, so she has an obligation to leave on the 29th of March, and she's just abrogated that. But so, I mean, to what extent does Parliament have to ratify this? Don't normally the treaties, things like this, they get decided by the people, it's voted on by Parliament, and then it's up to the government, that's her and her cabinet, to go away and get on with it.
Don't forget that Parliament's only been involved in this because of Gina Miller's appeal to the Supreme Court, because she wanted to just carry it through on executive orders. But Parliament, basically, because the judiciary stepped in, this is a Class A constitutional crisis in this country. It's probably as bad as anything going back to 1688 or 1916. And the Brexit has brought all this to the surface. The question of who gets a mandate to do what on what basis is now absolutely in your face.
So Archduke Karl is right, really. It's like entertaining for some people watching the British try to do what the people have decided. And they're saying,
it's like the breakup of Yugoslavia. The Croatians want to leave Yugoslavia, but the Bosnians and the others don't want to. And of course, that's this whole question of sovereignty is a much more dangerous thing than many middle-class English people realise.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free and all you need is your passport or ID card and to complete an online form. Support is available if you have any questions. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
Well, moving on to other news, and this week we've seen the demise of something called the Jeremy Kyle Show. I don't know if you were ever a fan of this show on ITV, Chris, were you?
I'd rather stick pins in my eyes and watch that.
Me too, Martin.
Yeah, well, I concur.
So, I mean, the ITV are throwing their hands up and saying, oh, gosh, we made a terrible mistake. Actually, it's part of an international franchise, this programme. The idea, it seems, is to sort of pit one person in a relationship against another and to get them screaming and shouting. And that brings in lots of viewers. Unfortunately, it's now led to a recent suicide and I think another death beforehand. What do you make of, Chris, first of all, this sort of television? I mean, I seem to remember back in the 1970s that you used to have discussion programmes talking about if television gets really, really bad, it could end up like Jeremy Kyle. But I mean, what do you make of how the model that's allowed this sort of TV to carry on and the TV companies think it's okay to make money, advertising revenue, from creating these kinds of exacerbating people's problems and hatred between each other?
Well, I think probably it's a throwback to the old Roman Empire where they had the emperor used to have the games in the Colosseum. And I think this is a modern equivalent. It's pitting people against one another. It's stirring them up. It's not nice. And as I said, I'd rather stick pins in my eyes, but as it's now been scrapped, do you want to buy any pins?
Martin, what do you think of the... why is it that we've got... I mean, it's supposed to be regulation of TV. I mean, they, for example, Ofcom potentially nearly took us and possibly even this whole station off the air for our comments about the Middle East, and yet this sort of show is allowed to carry on no problem at all.
Well, until it's not. I mean, they've now shot themselves in the head here, haven't they? Literally, and including the person who's killed themselves.
Well, no. I mean, what I'm saying is there seems to be some sort of, a lack of ethics in the regulation of TV that can allow a show to get to this sort of proportion, and for ITV bosses to say, well, actually, we're getting a lot of advertising revenue from this, so I think we better just ditch our morals this time.
Well, I think, as you say, Ofcom are pretty sharp on dealing with political bias and all the rest of it, but they've also got a brief to deal with this sort of thing. I mean, if you think back, we're going to talk about medieval Bristol in the second hour, but if you walk through medieval Bristol, you've seen bear baiting, people being hung, lots of whipping. it wouldn't have been fun, and of course people used to turn up on a Sunday with their picnics to watch it all.
So it's ITV taking us back to medieval Bristol anyway. So also another way in which some people say we're going back to medieval times is through austerity and the massive increase recently in child poverty.
Mr. Speaker, they may have changed the name, but the...
This is the Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, at Prime Minister's Questions.
...to over 5 million by 2022 at the current rate because of the strategies being followed by her government. When the wealth of the richest 1,000 people in Britain has increased by £50 billion in one year, but there's not enough money to properly feed our children or pay workers a decent wage, then we have failed as a society. This country is seeing the rich get richer while the poor get poorer, while the government is in the pockets of a super rich elite. More children in poverty, more pensioners in poverty, more people struggling to make ends meet. When is she and her government going to reverse the tax giveaways to the super rich and make sure they pay their fair share of taxes so we can end the scandal, and it is a scandal, of inequality in modern Britain?
Well, the Right Honourable Gentleman talks about, in fact, as I've pointed out, the top 1% are paying more in income tax today than they ever did under a Labour government. But what have we seen from Labour in just the past week? Labour Party has a plan for a system where everybody in this country would get benefits. That means handouts to hedge fund managers paid for by tax hikes on working people. Labour's policy, money for the rich paid by taxes on the poor.
Martin?
Well, I mean, if they're talking about universal benefit, or what they call, it's called universal credit or universal income, the reason you give it to everybody is so that nobody can moan. It's like family allowances. Everybody, however rich they were, got a family allowance. Because if you have to means test it, it's more fuss than
it's
worth. It's
more expensive, isn't it?
More expensive, that's right. That's why you give it everybody. So, and of course, when it turns up for the hedge fund manager, it's just an extra tax cut for them. Yeah. So they get their whatever it is, 100 quid a week, as if it was a tax break, just like all the other tax breaks they get.
But she's talking about handouts for hedge fund managers, and this is something that Labour supports.
Well, I'm talking about the whole basic concept of universal income, which was actually originally invented by Milton Friedman, who was Margaret Thatcher's great hero. He called it negative income tax. The purpose of having everybody on one benefit is it's just much more simple. You just bang, that's it. Everybody just gets it. So middle class people and hedge fund managers can't moan because they get it as well. But of course, what we're going to do is raise taxes on the hedge fund people to pay for it.
Anyway, Britain is risking, apparently, Chris, this is the article that's being referred to there, or the study. Reuters tells us Britain risks following the rise in inequality seen in the US, which could weaken democracy. Nobel Prize winning economists said on Tuesday at the loss of a major review into differences in income, education, and health. Angus Deaton said Britain could follow the US, where wages for non-college educated men had not risen for 5 decades. Now, this isn't looking good, is it? I mean, this is, I suppose, part of the problem of being so close to the US in all sorts of different ways. Maybe moving away from the EU and becoming more, have a closer relationship with the US, is that this sort of thing is likely to happen.
Well, we should never have given the American colonies independence. I mean, that's really it. There is a root cause of it. But as far as report from Reuters is concerned, well, I don't take an awful lot of notice what the international news agencies decide to say, or about papers that are written by people who want to get into the news. And as far as Jeremy Corbyn's speech was concerned, well, what can one say? Was he told to say that from the Kremlin, or what?
No, he's just been picked up on something that's been in the news, isn't he? And also, I mean, these are senior economists are saying that the levels of inequality in the UK, I mean, we've had a welfare state for a long time, which is designed to redistribute wealth to a certain extent, make sure that there's nobody that's got absolutely nothing. And now we're in a situation where, you know, we could have millions of, well, we've already got millions of children in poverty, and that is set to increase unless we do something.
Well, I have to say that I don't see any sign of that in my ward. And my ward is not what one would call a rich ward by any stretch of the
imagination. Martin, in a way, Chris has hit the nail on the head there, hasn't he? Because some areas, there's enormous amounts of poverty, and they're becoming like sink estates, etc., and other areas are doing okay.
Well, that's right. I mean, people, you only know, people don't necessarily know everything that's going on, which is why we have professionals going out and collecting statistics and all the rest of it. I mean, I think there's a pretty clear example. What's happened because of the bailout of the banks in 2008 is that the super rich have actually made out like bandits. They should have, the banks should have been allowed to collapse before a free market
philosophy.
Well, some
people call this,
and those people,
Martin,
should have been bankrupt.
Some people
in bankruptcy
call this,
courts and sent
I mean,
to prison.
I should address this to you, Chris. Some people call this socialism for the rich.
Well, yeah, there's some truth in that, with certain individuals, even locally. But, I mean, the bank collapse, I mean, that hit an awful lot of people, and it's cost the country a lot of money, and that happened in 2008, wasn't
yeah.
it? So, sorry, who was in power then?
Oh, it was Gordon Brown, wasn't it?
Oh, it was
yes.
Mr. Brown.
Yeah, yes, that's right. And, of course, why we've had a fight back in the Labour Party against the Brownite Blairite era is because they should have raised taxes. They should have. If they're going to bail the banks out, they should have sent them all to prison. And, of course, the whole thing started in the United States where they created the collateralised debt obligation mountain. They should never have been allowed. Now, in actual fact, all of the inequality which we've seen in the last 10 years comes from that bank bailout. And, of course, we're going to have another banking collapse soon enough. And then, of course, we're going to say to the people with the money, you didn't get that money by building a better widget. You got it from us. That's our money. We're having it back. And of course, they'll fight at that point. And in some countries, they'll fight with weaponry.
What do you think about the idea of redistributing some of that wealth, which is we're seeing these inequality increasing, Chris?
Well, I'd like to have a bit redistributed in my direction. I certainly say that. I've never been rich, but I have to be honest and say I've never been abysmally poor either.
Now, the thing is also, you were for quite a while in the city one of the chairs of the two planning committees. Since Marvin Rees, Labour Mayor, has taken over, he's for a while you were allowed to continue as chair. Can you just tell us a bit about the politics around that? Because planning, of course, is really important. One of the things that the city is seeing right now is a massive boom in student building student blocks, enormous, great, most of them ugly, faceless student accommodation, really, because that's the only people that seem to have any money are those that can go and get student loans, and there's a lot of other people. I mean, basically the housing market is potentially anyway depressed at the moment. It seems reached its peak, but the one group of people that does have money is students, because they can go out and get these guaranteed loans. So that's the main thing that's going on. So anyway, what do you make of the student loan thing and how planning's working in the city, Chris?
Well, I think there's a lot of people that have been encouraged to go to university that really shouldn't have been. It was a political move. I think it did them no favours at all. They would probably have been a lot happier and a lot better off in the long run if they'd taken a different route to their employment.
So why? Why were they? What was the motive behind that?
Well, if I remember back to the various courses that were open when I was of the age to go to university, they were pretty straightforward. Most people could name the various ones, but nowadays you've got so many different courses that, quite frankly, that's the reason you've got so many graduates who are out of work or who are doing a job which is totally beneath their capabilities, or should be.
Okay, well, that's that. But what about planning in the city? Do you think it's fit for purpose? Marvin has said he wants to build up, doesn't he?
Yes, Marvin, yes. yes. Well, let me just say this to you. I've had a lot of experience planning over the up to 11 years that I've been involved in the city, as far as a councillor is concerned. But last year, our elected mayor, Marvin Rees, hope he's listening, decided in his wisdom that only people who were Labour councillors were fit to be in charge of the various committees, any of the committees. And that included the statutory planning committees. And
so has he been putting people who are big fans of his and, you know, constantly on the TV saying how wonderful he is? Has he been putting them in charge of these planning committees?
Well, I've not come across anybody that would fit into that category recently.
Okay, good. But anyway, so, I mean, is it fit for purpose, do you think? Is it working? Because there's a lot of pressure, isn't there, from the developers on you councillors saying, look, this is like basically gold bars for us if you give us planning permission here.
Well, I've not seen any gold bars come my way.
Oh, for them, not for you.
Oh, for them. Well, yeah, of course they're in the business to make money. And I don't think there's anything wrong with making money, provided you do it in the proper way. I don't see that they're in a position to actually twist our arms. I think that the whole planning committee, and that includes councillors from all the different parties, I think really take great deal of care in coming to their decisions. I really do think that. And politics doesn't come into it. And if Mayor Rees is listening, politics don't come into it. I'll repeat it again.
Martin Summers, a lot of pressure, isn't there, on Marvin to deliver development? I mean, because he's quite close to some of these big developers. Do you think it's potentially a bad idea to have his own people chairing those committees and making... Well, they're not making their decision on their own, are they, Chris? You know, this is quite an important role that he's got, saying whether or not a big developer is going to build a load of student flats or not, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, when he first was elected, and of course the Labour Party's got a majority on the council anyway, so whether we had a mayor or not, it'd still be a Labour council. He inherited from Ferguson the idea of having an all-party administration. And I thought, I was quite opposed to that at first, but when Ferguson made a go of it, I thought, well, this could be quite useful. It doesn't mean that the party political differences have disappeared, far from it, but it means that, you know, we're going to try and run it as a joint enterprise. But I think he then made the decision that he was going to run it, you know, like other major cities are run, as a Labour Party fiefdom. And of course, he's perfectly within his rights to do that. That's how Manchester's run. That's how Birmingham's run. That's how most of the other major, all the eight major core cities are run by the Labour Party, with the Labour Party controlling all the committees. So it was a bit of an exception for Bristol to have a different approach. So I was a bit surprised when he did it, because if you've inherited something, you might as well carry it on as it is and work within that. But if it's up to him, it's his decision, and that's what he decided to do.
Chris, see also on the Bristol Post website that Theresa May's actually been in Bristol today, the Prime Minister, to launch the Conservatives' election campaign. Not a great deal of enthusiasm, though. I don't know, were you down there?
Where?
Well, I don't know where she was, but she was somewhere in Bristol. Were you invited or not?
Good Lord, no, I'm not that important, surely.
Okay, but also, Tory councillor Richard Eddy, who was on this show a few weeks ago, he launched a blistering attack against the Prime Minister and against the government. He says it also that it's not just about Brexit. Richard Eddy said he represents the Bishopsworth ward, wrote a letter to Bristol Live, that is effectively the Bristol Post online, explaining his outrage and disillusionment with the party he's been a member of for more than 30 years. He says his frustration goes way beyond the betrayal of Brexit. He's listed a number of policies and comments made by senior Tory politicians he sees as a betrayal of the party's core beliefs, including the prosecution of veteran soldiers who served in Northern Ireland, the government's support for transsexual rights, and the decision to allow Chinese telecom giant Huawei, in principle, to supply non-core 5G mobile equipment in the UK, Martin.
Well, that's Richard's view. That's all I can say about that. Not mine.
So, 5G, Huawei, no comment on there? Northern Ireland, troubles?
Well, I mean, these things are all litmus tests of left-wing or right-wing opinion, and, you know, Richard's got his views, they're not my views. And, of course, this is all going to be tested at the ballot box, and we shall see where we end up.
What do you make of those comments, Chris? Someone from the same party?
Richard is on the fire authority with me. He works very, very hard on the fire authority. He has views on occasions that don't coincide with my own. But although I don't agree with him on some things, he's got every right to express those views, I think. And the move in this country to stop free speech is in nobody's interest.
Well, free speech in Italy has been apparently under attack today. Facebook has closed 23 pages in Italian with 2.4 million followers, spreading what they say is, inverted commas, fake news and another, more inverted commas, words of hate. Most of them were in support of La Liga and the Five Star Movement. And I'll put a link up to that on our show page. And the complaint was made by Avaz, which is a campaign group, to Facebook, a letter. And then Facebook closed all these Italian, 2.4 million followers. That's a lot of people. Facebook being told, no, you've got to take these down. Just so happens, Chris, that both of those are Eurosceptic parties. So it does look as if Facebook are... I mean, we've been told the Russians are fixing our elections. Facebook are now saying anti-Brexit parties in Italy, we're going to switch off their Facebook accounts a week before the EU elections.
Well, I'm not on Facebook. And as far as I'm concerned, the sooner they shut it down, the better.
Martin?
Well, Facebook is a private corporation in a monopoly position, but they're entitled to do whatever they like. Just as the Daily Telegraph doesn't print stuff they don't agree with, if they don't like it, they don't print it.
I suppose Facebook could turn the Daily Telegraph off too, as well.
You don't have to use Facebook to use the internet.
I mean, isn't it?
People have chosen to use it.
Isn't it a fact though that election law has actually not kept up with social media and the way?
Well, it's not
working.
Just social media. Look at all the money that's spent on elections in the US. Any amount of money can be spent on elections.
This story's about social media, particularly, right? And isn't it interesting?
Why focus on social media instead of money?
Well, because social media, we're being told the Russians are fixing our elections. Well
that's a load of nonsense.
Isn't it interesting
isn't it?
How Facebook's just decided to switch off two parties over in Italy?
Well, in the 1940s, as I explained earlier, the CIA directly intervened in the Italian election. They spent millions and millions of dollars via the mafia to keep the communists out with taxpayer money.
Another story is on G4S, which is well loved by this programme after our programme back in, I think it was 2012, wasn't it? The Olympics, yeah. Martin, when we exposed they're not actually doing any real security at the London Olympics. G4S ambulance crew members accidentally recorded themselves saying they could beat the bleep bleep out of a mental health patient. I'll put a link up to that on our show page, but we've got to go now for the news at 7. Thanks to our guest, Conservative Councillor for Henbury and Brentree, Chris Windows. Join us after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. We spread our wings around the world and talk medieval Bristol.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.